The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer podcast on Fox Sports. The Christmas season is here upon us and we are one man down today. Dave Edwards is unfortunately not here with us today, but Sam Perry does join me from snowing London. My name is Ian Higgins and on the show today, Pez, we've got batting coach to the stars. His clientele includes Steve Smith, Virat Kohli, David Warner. He's some sort of like secret batting whisperer or something sexy like that. Also on the show, UK journalist from The Times, Will McPherson. But the voices you will hear first this afternoon, this morning. What, I don't know what time it is. I don't even know what day it is, Pez. It's like it's that time of the year. I've lost all track of days. But Sam Perry, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Welcome to you, Higgins. Yeah,
If you do
struggle with this podcast today, it's because two people talking are barely putting combinations of words together after what appears to. I mean, I'm looking at you, Higgins. There's a bottle of Diet Coke by you, 1.25 litres. I've got a whole plunge of coffee here because it's 10 in the morning and it's snowing outside. And it's been a fairly solid festive season. Put it that way, but I think we can push through. The first thing I want to ask you, Higgos, and firstly, I want to say to you, Higgos, Merry Christmas to all the listeners. Happy holidays, however you like to get it done. Really, you know, it doesn't matter how you get them, as they say in cricket. Was there any cricket themed things happening for you on Christmas Day, Higgos, or did we just tweet our thoughts?
Nah, I just tweeted stuff, mate. I got some validation from strangers on the internet in whatever capacity I could. No cricket themed for me over the Christmas or on Christmas Day anyway. I spent some time with my sister and her husband and three kids. A little bit too young yet to get the old backyard cricket set out, so I couldn't alpha anybody. So my affair was just sort of just quintessential Australian, you know, Christmas Day, that kind of vibe. But Pez, you had the privilege of the orphans' Christmas, you know?
Had an orphans' Christmas. 10 people came over. There wasn't enough space for it, but lots of, you know, good food and too much drink. Don't have the property space nor the weather for backyard cricket. But, I mean, there was some cricket-themed stuff. You know, charades ended up happening and we're all pretty pissed and my wife thought it was funny on multiple occasions to ask people to enact the grade cricketer or tea and no sympathy in charades. And, you know, I pretended I was really humble about it. I'm like, nah, don't do it, babe. But I'm like, nah, do it. Yeah, keep doing it.
Do it.
Keep talking about the ball. But I did want to say on that note, we were very humbled to receive a lot of pictures and messages from people who did receive the book for Christmas. Hope you do enjoy it. And all feedback is welcome. Also, if you haven't got the book, get it, please. That's the extent of our advertising.
So Pez, I suppose the biggest cricketing theme over the Christmas break is, of course, the Boxing Day Test match. It happens every year. It happens on the 26th of December, and it's always in Melbourne. And that's where a test match is happening right now. And I don't know about you, but I had to drink most of my way through the first 2 days of this test match because, like, man, I'm not sure what's in it for me now, you know? Like, you know, listeners of the show will know that all I've ever wanted for Christmas, you know, is a hug from Dad. But apart from that is, you know, is a live rubber for Melbourne and Sydney. I want you know, something to play for. I want something to play for come January 4 or whenever Sydney Test match is, you know? Yeah. And I'm not getting it. And then there's this fucking drop-in pitch in Melbourne. The ball's not moving. It doesn't swing. And there's those ring fields. You got to hit the ball. Like, it's just like, what's in it for me, Pez? What's in it for me?
Yeah. Well, we all, and we can't say enough how important live rubbers are. But mate, it's been the same for me. I've had this real, sort of dilemma thinking about this over the last few days because I've noted your comments, you know, both on WhatsApp and Twitter and stuff, just saying how boring the cricket is and this is just ordinary and we need a contest. And a lot of people echo your thoughts on that. One thing that, you know, like the only opposition I have to that is to kind of enjoy the dominance while you can as an Australian mm-hmm. fan, because in mm-hmm. 18 months' time, I'm sure that, you know, that none for 102 session we had will be, you know, 4 for 40, yep. wherever it is at Headingley or Trent Bridge, and we'll mm-hmm. be thinking, yeah, you know what, the safety and the relaxation of none for 100 was fantastic, and let's just enjoy it, because, you know, in 18 months' time, we will be copying it, and we'll be copying it in reaction to the way we're giving it to them at the moment. And so the cycle yep. will go. So I'm trying to be grateful yep. mm. for how good it is. Although England are on top, I suppose, in this test as we go to where. But then again, he goes, yeah, mm. the whole stump to stump. I mean, I feel like I'm watching test match players enact a third grade match. It's like a third grade theatre yeah. show. Yeah. It's stump to stump. Jackson yeah. Bird, he's bowling at middle. He strays to middle and leg. Mm. You know, Cook or Root whipping through mid wicket. There's two. Mm-hmm. There's a short mid wicket. There's a short cover. Mm. All the trappings of lower grade mm. cricket are there to be seen at the MCG, and it just reminds you, you know, there's nothing in that wicket for anybody. There's nothing no. in it for batsmen, for spinners, no. for bowlers. Mm-hmm. But gee, it's a good stadium.
Yeah, I take your point, Pez, that maybe I need to be happy at some point in my life, and maybe when Australia are 3-0 up, you know, the team that I support are winning, maybe that's a good thing. I was actually thinking about this the other day, because you, also being an NBA fan, would know that the NBA have 5 games on Christmas Day, and it makes me wonder, like, how far away we are from, you know, a BBL game being played on December 25. But anyway, that's another story for another time. But I was just thinking, like, you know, American sports are so... you know, they're socialist in a lot of ways, ironically, because when you think America, you think like capitalism, but like their sports are so like, you know, like the Golden State Equalized. Warriors in the NBA. Yes, exactly. Yeah. The Golden State Warriors right now, if you're a Golden State Warriors fan, it's never going to get any better in your entire life than right now. So like, do you go all in, you know, do you go all in? Do you buy the Curry jersey, you know, the Durant jumper, you know, do you go all in, do you go every single game home and away? Because, you know, in 3 years time, when that team gets disassembled, you know, it's going to be grim, and they're going to be the bottom of the Western State yeah. Conference, you know? So like, maybe I should be happy that, you know, Mitch Marsh got 180 last week. Maybe I should be happy that, you know, that these matches are dead rubbers. I don't know. Maybe I'm just never happy.
There's the title of the show. I know exactly what you mean. Like, it occurred to me, he goes, you know, they say sex sells, right?
They do.
And, you know, things need to be equated to sex. I mean, you know, we all know that. And that's why test cricket is such a, like, a mouthwatering prospect, because when it's good, it's like the most, the greatest sort of sex marathon. Oh, hello, Mum, if you're listening. It's like the greatest sex marathon or any future employers of all time. But also when it's really bad and dull, like just military precision, missionary sort of stuff, like it is at the MCG at the moment. Lots you're like, when contact. Is this over? And that's why the Big Bash is good. Like, you know, if the Big Bash is a shit game, at least it's over in a couple of hours. Where I feel like this MCG test, and you just watch now, it'll be one of the greatest Ashes tests of all time.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of like enduring this like 5 days of bad sex. That's what I'm saying there. All I've got in my notes here is test cricket as bad sex.
It's a long bow and you've gone for it, and it's worked. I've bought in. Yeah, I know what you mean. And there's something about, like, I mean, how many times can you say, oh, it's great, the Boxing Day, people off work and stuff. Well, that doesn't, like, it doesn't affect the quality of the cricket. I don't know. Maybe we're being a little bit too negative, because it does appear at this stage, of course, it's a real risk to know. I mean, people listen to this podcast at different times throughout the week, obviously, but so we could say anything about this match and it'll be completely untrue by one session tomorrow. But it is in some ways. I mean, Australia lost like 6 for 30. Am I right in saying that? 6 for 70, or they lost their last 6 wickets very quickly. And so England have started doing well. They've batted very well. Nice to see Alistair Cook in the runs. Can you think of another player, Pez, in the England setup in the last, say, I don't know, let's say a couple of decades, who is as respected as Alistair Cook?
No, not really. I mean, I suppose like Freddie Flintoff was respected, but like in a different way. He was more of a kind of a court jester who we wish played for us.
Yeah.
So he's kind of like Channel 9 respect, whereas Alistair Cook is like old money respect.
He's like
the guy that would have kind of... No, I won't say that, actually. I was going to talk about owning people, but that's just stupid, and I withdraw the comment unreservedly. No, I can't. And it's nice to see Alistair Cook score runs, isn't it? And then it gets really boring because he's just like a metronome.
He's a metronome, he's a metronome, exactly. Well, I mean, to sort of juxtapose that, Australia's left-handed opening batsman, his name is David Warner. And, geez, he seems like a lovely bloke, doesn't he? So, like, let's go to that whole passage of play where he's on 99. England have strangled him, essentially. They've bowled about 3 feet outside. I think Broad bowled a ball which actually bounced in Bay 13. It was bowling so far wide of off stump, but it was working. He was patient, Warner. I think Warner at that point was thinking, I'm going to get 200 today. Anyway, young Tom Curran comes on to bowl I have to say his haircut does not suit his style of hair, but that's, again, aside. That'll be for the bonus features of the DVD of this episode.
I'm not going to judge.
So he comes on. He hasn't got a test wicket yet. And Warner plays, I'm trying to think of a more yuck shot than I've seen an international batsman play, particularly in test cricket, in 20 years. I can't think of the last yuck shot. But yeah, it was revolting the way he got out.
Yeah,
it was a no ball.
Can I just say, it was like a Christmas Day shot when you sort of hit 80 odd and like your dad's gone, like, can you just hit Tommy a catch? He's just been waiting to play.
Exactly.
And so he sort of just bunted it in the air and pretended it. He didn't do it on purpose.
That was a shot that like a guy like a rugby player who's never played cricket would like hit a ball. Like it was, you know, like when a guy comes to your school and he's just like he's having a hit at lunchtime and he gets a bat and it's all like horizontal.
Or like sometimes when they match up like baseball players and cricket players and they give the baseball player a cricket bat and they just don't know how to swing the bat.
I think if the ICC had anything about him, Warner should be suspended for the shot because it was just, I mean, like, they're trying to keep test cricket alive and that's just, it was yuck. Anyhow, so he gets out. It's a no ball. And then Curran gives him a bit of chirp. Then Warner just absolutely rips in between the over. I don't know how you felt about that, Pez, but it didn't sit well with me. I don't care about it being like a bad look for the game. I just think like you're representing yourself, and it's just like it didn't look good, man. What do you think?
Yeah, but he goes, the bully's back. You know, I mean, what do you say about that? I mean, he was the reverend, but now let the bull be the bull. You know. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I am enjoying your kind of like old hat sensibilities, though. I mean, on the last show, you were decrying the short pitch bowling, which, you know, I admire you for. And now it's, you know, Warner should keep his mouth, you know, shut and just bat. There's a bit of old money in you yet, he goes.
Oh, look, yeah, the conservative, you know, white privilege runs deep in this podcast, Pez. I don't know. I don't know what my problem is, but I just want people to be nice to each other, I think. And I just think, like, you know, he doesn't...
Is it so hard?
Why can't everyone just get along? I think that's my point, isn't it? Why can't everyone just get along? Stop bouncing Jimmy. Stop sledging the test debutant when he's got, you know, he's made a mistake. Why can't everyone just be mates?
So many people are going to be so disappointed to hear that. Are you saying the great cricketer writers are actually nice people? No, it's not true. This is an act. This is very meta. Very meta. Yeah, no, I totally agree. He goes, this is all a function of just being generally disappointed that the rubbers aren't live, and you got to go to Sydney next week, and it will be exactly the same situation.
So the BBL has been a thing that's been going on, Pez. You're in London, as previously stated many times in this podcast. I want to know, just from your perspective, like I've got a lot of really good friends who live in the UK, and they'll listen to the show. Shout out to them, but they love the Big Bash. They love it. And it's obviously a hugely successful brand here. And a lot of people in the UK are upset that, you know, England themselves don't have a similar style of, you know, branding for their own competition in the UK. But like, well, I mean, what's your sort of perspective? What's your read on it over there? Are people frothing on it?
Yeah. Before I moved over here, frothing. Yeah, exactly. That's more Aussie. That's more like it. Before I moved over here, a lot of my UK friends too said that they loved the Big Bash League, and I was keen to understand what that was about. But yeah, being over here, it's a timing thing. Obviously, it's just the most perfect marketing package in 2017, you know, Australian sport. Like they say, you know, if you had to design Test cricket now as a sport, you just would kill it. You wouldn't have it at all. And I think the Big Bash is the opposite. It is the perfect marketing package for sport. And it works really well over here. Yeah, it's on from about 8 a.m. in the morning till, you know, 10 or 11. You know, if you work in an office that shows the sport or has BT, which is a cable channel, you know, it's on. It's just so digestible. You know, red versus blue, and you know, a couple of characters. I mean, I don't know. I think when you, like, people who are deeper connoisseurs of T20 cricket would say that it's not even close to the best T20 cricket around, but they get the tribal part of it right. And people like it here. And then as for the UK T20 conversation, I'm actually like, it actually makes me nervous to talk about it because it's a very, very sensitive issue here. Because until you move here, I don't think you appreciate how deeply set and historically significant the counties are, and the impact of a T20 competition on county cricket you know, isn't fully understood yet. So I think people, like, rationally understand something like this has to happen, and they do have a T20 comp, it must be said, but they are nervous about the franchise idea, and you can actually feel a lot of the old English conservatism come through in that conversation. I think there's some fear about it. It would, you know, be very easy for me to go like, oh, look, they've got to do it, you know, we're light years ahead. But, you know, let's be honest, I don't know about the sensitivities or the issues with it. But get it. Make sure that, you know, KP can play a bit more.
I think just, you know, from just a pure marketing perspective, which is literally 95% of the Big Bash marketing. But, like, you know, I was kind of thinking this evening, I was watching the first half of a game here tonight, and it was I was thinking, like, oh, well, they could have played, like, the, you know, the ING Cup or the, whatever it's called, the one day comp or the Sheffield Shield, you know, they could be playing.
So old school.
And then I was like, well, they did do that and nobody fucking watched it. Nobody cares about it. I mean, we spoke about this last year, like, the Big Bash isn't for us. It's not for us. It's for new. It's, you know, it's the new crowd, and it's doing a bloody amazing job of that. And it is good. It's a great time of year. It's a match on every single night for like 6 weeks. It's during the summer break. You know, you finish watching the test match, you grab some dinner, and then you're watching the Big Bash. It is, like, it is amazing. But sorry, I just blacked out for a second there.
Yeah, no, the beers have taken hold. Oh, I can't help you either. I normally step in, but I've got nothing. Should we forward announce Will McPherson coming up next?
I don't play cricket for results. I don't come to take wickets, score runs, or win games. I play cricket to look good. Rigs, chests, pipes, circuits, salads. This is my domain. So when I hit the sheds, I need to radiate success. That's why I use Chop King Cologne by TGC. With a blend of the finest handcrafted English willow and Kookaburra Red King leather, Chop King Cologne lets me radiate cricket. Whatever the ground, whatever the circuit. Chop King Cologne, the new fragrance for men by TGC. Reek of runs without hitting them.
He's our favourite Englishman. He's kindly serviced us with the view from the UK. From the UK side of the press box, that is. It's Will McPherson of the Times, riding alongside such luminaries as Mike Atherton and Gideon Haigh. Will, welcome back to the Great Cricketer, mate. What's the update from Australia?
Thanks for having me, lads. Yeah, I mean, we're talking at the end of what's been possibly England's best ever series, actually. not that much of it matters now, but Ali Cook's just made a ton, and Stuart Broad took a few wickets. So it's we're in slightly better spirits than we have been at other stages of this tour, that's for sure.
Yeah, mate. I mean, so what's the so as we go to air now, it's the end of day two of this MCG test.
Yep.
And I guess for the first time, yeah, the English guys who we sort of expected to perform have started doing it. Do you take much solace from it at all, or is it, you know? I mean, I'm in the UK. Is the feel in the press box that it's too little, too late?
It's really weird because, like, England might still get whitewashed. And normally at whitewash time, we've obviously been two in the recent past. it's sort of it's kind of time for a clear out. You expect this sort of big overhaul of players, careers. You know, Nathan Lyon talked about wanting to end careers a few weeks ago, and actually, you, this time there's not really that much of a case for. There's not many obvious blokes to lop off and get rid of, and equally not that many obvious candidates to come through. So, like, the guys who've been, until today, the guys who've been operating well below what you'd see as their station are Cook, Broad, Moeen Ali, to a lesser extent, Root, who's been under a lot of pressure as captain. They've got, they're the sort of established heads. Chris Wokes hasn't performed quite as well as I thought he might. But I don't for a second think, and I didn't think after they lost in Perth, I don't for a second think that these guys have done. And it's much easier to say that. I can say that with considerably more confidence now that two of them have actually performed today. Hindsight's wonderful, isn't it? But I don't actually think, you know, we're all, a few of the English journalists are looking around going, because we know that our editors are going to be coming to us soon and telling us whose careers we, you know, whose careers need ending and stuff like that. And I genuinely...
That is how it works, isn't it?
I genuinely don't have a clue who I'm going to, whose heads I'm going to be calling for when they lose 5-0. I've got no idea. You know, I don't think the selectors have been that bad. I don't think the coaches have, you know, I think the coaches are all right. The players have done okay in patches. I just don't know who to lop off.
Someone's got to go.
So,
exactly. Heads must roll.
So on that, I mean, I think before this test match, a lot of people perhaps wrongly were saying that Alistair Cook is going to have to retire at the end of this series, which for my own thoughts is a wild thing, given that he's now just scored 32 test match hundreds. But how important was it, just in like the public you know, opinion, if that holds any weight, which it probably does, you know, how important was it for Cook to score 100 before the end of this tour?
Yeah, I think it probably does matter, actually. I don't think he'll walk away. And it will be on his own terms that he goes, I'm sure about that. You know, he's got so much credit in the bank. But the thing about Cook is, if you write him off, I can't tell you how stupid people are to write off Alistair Cook, because his batting is nothing to do with sort of his quality particularly. It's all just about rhythm, and he slips in and out of rhythm, and he'll go 10 innings without 50, and then he'll score a double 100, and he'll just get on hot streaks like the one he had in Australia in 2010, where he scored 760 runs. I mean, I think I'm right in saying that he hasn't had another Ashes series. He's played five or six others, including this one. He hasn't had another Ashes series where he's averaged more than about 35. He's never scored an Ashes 100 in England. He's never... But he just goes in these weird peaks and troughs where, and just because he's in one of those troughs doesn't mean that it's remotely permanent. So you just have to let him ride it, and then he will come through the other side. Probably his greatest trough was it took in the Ashes tour of 13-14, and then most of the next English summer. And then he scored this absolutely disgustingly ugly 95. at the Aegeus Bowl in Southampton against India. And that sort of was like a... People were talking then about it being like a career salvager, all this kind of nonsense. But, you know, he comes through these patches and he'll score, you know... I honestly reckon he could catch Sachin Tendulkar's number of test runs, but, I mean, that's a long way down the line. It's all about... Basically, it's for him, it's about when the hunger runs out. And it may be that even this 100 today, it might help the hunger run out a little bit, if you know what I mean. He's had that, he's had a great moment. And he might think, you know, how much longer do I need to do this for? I don't know. It's basically just completely up to him. And I think one very ordinary series like he was having, or even still today, he's probably still only averaging in the mid-20s for this series. That's how bad he'd been before. I don't think that spells the end for him.
Mate, I want to ask you, because I think that Australia internationally have an advantage, because I think probably the hardest place to travel for a touring side would be India. India is probably the hardest place to go and play cricket and win over there. And then after that, it's probably Australia, like famously a really difficult place to come. And obviously Australia never have to tour Australia because that is where their home is. So I want to ask, like, how hard is it to win here? Like for someone who comes out here every 4 years, like, I mean, how hard is it to actually win in Australia compared to like India or like South Africa, New Zealand, you know, West Indies and stuff? It's a little bit easier to win, but like in Australia, it just seems extraordinarily difficult to play well even.
Yeah, it's an interesting point because I think what's happening with the English media, English fans, English players even, is that they now look back on that series win in 10-11. Like, yeah, every single day that goes past, that series win becomes better.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, it becomes more incredible. It becomes more of an anomaly. You know, all of the other three Ashes series in Australia this century have been over at Perth. Like, the team England played in 10-11 was by far the weakest Australian team they've played, but it still has some damn good players. Still Ponting, Clark, that lot, Hussey. And England were very strong at that time, but it absolutely, like, it actually baffles me as to how they won here now, looking back at that. I think it's like, there's technical reasons. It's really difficult. You know, places like Perth are difficult for a touring side to go and play where the bounce is much steeper. Yeah. If you talk to pros, and you guys will know this for a while, but they talk about how it's far more difficult to adjust to the ball bouncing more steeply than you're used to, even less steeply, because obviously it's just more extreme. So if an Aussie comes to a slow low one in England, it, you know, shouldn't actually, technically, it shouldn't trouble them that much. You just have to be slightly more patient. Whereas English batsmen obviously get rushed here, and then the media is impressive. Like, I've just as I was waiting for your call there, I've seen the back page of tomorrow's Courier Mail, and it's got the picture of Cook celebrating his 100, and it just says, "Thanks for turning up." And it's like, you know, it's just, it's, and they're able to block this. It's decent, isn't it? They're able to block this stuff out. But, like, it's a pretty brutal environment. I think you get heckled here. And I know people were talking about Mitchell Johnson, the Barney Army and stuff like that. But I think you do get heckled here more from the stands as a player than anywhere else. It is just a bloody tough place to come and talk. And so, I mean, congratulations to the people of Australia for making it quite so difficult, because that is, you know, that's half a battle, isn't it?
Well, it's actually really funny you say that, Will. You know, in the context of whether we need scalps or careers need to end, I mean, like, the logic would dictate that if players don't perform, you know, at the level they're at test level, then therefore someone else should get a go. But winning away from home, or just playing away from home, has become so different to playing at home that you're almost forced to ask yourself, well, even if Cook can't score runs here when it matters, or Broad can't take a wicket, or, you know, Anderson is, let's say, less effective than he normally is, you almost think it doesn't really matter, because in 18 months' time, I could see all three of them just knocking us over anyway. You know,
that's exactly the thing.
Like, well, yeah, okay, even if they didn't score runs here, it doesn't mean their careers are over. It just means that it's really hard to play in Australia, and when they get home, we'll all forget about it, and they'll just be great again.
Yeah, I'd like to think that when, like, I'd like to think that when Mitchell Marsh was, and I rate Mitchell Marsh, by the way, this is not a dig, I'd like to think that when he was panning Broad and Anderson round Perth for the tune of 181 or whatever he got, that those two were just thinking, "I'll see you at Trent Bridge, fella," because, you know, it's just, it's so different here. Another thing that's become more difficult about any tour, and this is same to England and Australia, is that the warm-ups that England had for this tour, and this is, again, not a whinge, but it's the same when people come to England, but they were just absolute dross. You know, they've got
ridiculous,
three crap games at, against really poor opposition, which don't, like, it doesn't prepare you for facing Mitchell Stark. So they come in a bit cold, get caught on the hop a little bit. They have to do all their preparation. So playing away from home is really very hard now. And that's why, and actually, you're saying about winning in Australia, but it's even longer since Australia won in England. They last won in England in 01. And England won here in 10-11. So, you know, I expect England will win the Ashes back in 2019, I imagine.
That's the great bragging rights you can have now, though, you know, that all Australia can say is, yeah, but we do better, we lose better than you lose here. that's about
well,
the
that
only
is the
way.
Thing, isn't it? Yeah. English Ashes tours. And this is another weird thing about this tour. I really don't think they've imploded. Like, English Ashes tours have this amazing way. 06, 07 and 13, 14, completely, everything falls to pieces. They all start hating each other. They want to beat each other, all this kind of stuff. But this time they've been... They're actually genuinely all getting on, and they're working hard still.
Yeah, the media just wants the implosion so bad. don't they? They just want the implosion so bad. And but the England guys are just like playing their cricket, trying their best, you know, executing their plans, as they say, as well as they can. But they're just losing because, you know, the Australian guys are quite good on their own home patch. That's all that's happening.
I mean, when England somehow contrived to lose this Test match, and I look forward to seeing how they do that, but it will genuinely be the weirdest whitewash ever. I mean, I can't. It's completely unexplainable.
So, well, let's go back to yesterday, day one, Boxing Day. December 26th was Boxing Day this year. Tom Curran was having a bowl. He gets his first wicket, the prize wicket of David Warner on 99. What happens, happens, and Warner then somehow gives a bowler a send-off or something. Mm-hmm. Can you talk us through the English reaction of how high esteem is Dave Warner held in the UK right now?
I wouldn't think that he received that many Christmas cards from the UK.
but a few.
I can think of at least 16 Englishmen who actively loathe him. And, you know, plenty more besides. He's an interesting fish, isn't he?
Yes.
He just sort of, he sings when he's winning, but he also seems to sing quite loud when things aren't going his way as well. He's remarkable. Mm. But he's not, you know, that was a genuinely incredible passage of play. And it was quite fun. I mean, I went outside to watch Warner get his 100, and actually England had him on toast, really, didn't they? They had a plan, and I was out there for 7 overs. I went when he was on 96. I thought I was just going to go and watch a couple of balls, and he was going to twat one through point, and then that'd be that. But they tied him down, and then they sort of got him out, and then it proved that he wasn't out, and all that. Yeah, it was absolutely incredible theatre. And I actually thought, while the footage didn't look great, but I thought them all absolutely gobbing off at each other was spectacular. And frankly, like Tom Curran's a notoriously gobby cricketer, so I'm not surprised that he pledged Warner having just bowled a no ball at him. That doesn't really shock me. Like, I like Tom Curran a lot, but I've seen him sledge 16-year-olds in county cricket. So, I mean, let's not pretend that just because he's on debut, he doesn't cop a bit. So, that was a great passage. It was hilarious.
Okay.
I'm just trying to read between the lines, Will, here as we finish up. You know, as a journo writing for the Times, it's good to see you just stepping outside to actually watch the cricket for a couple of balls. You seem to be really, really well in the rhythm of touring in Australia. I just want to know what the circuit's been like, what the Melbourne circuit holds for you and Sydney.
Melbourne's a good circuit, isn't it? Sydney, looking forward to that. I spoke to you before we went there, but I still stand by Townsville being the best circuit in Australia. Absolutely spectacular scenes up there. Had 5 steaks in 8 nights. Lots of awful beer. It was great.
There's nothing like actually living in the UK and just hearing some of your colleagues talk about how difficult it is to get into places and how poorly treated they are by security guards, just to remind you that it's nice to be in London a little bit and not be out in Australia at times. It must have been a bit of a rude awakening just to see that you're basically a peasant when you're ever at a bar in Australia.
Yeah, there's been a couple of good ones like that. George DeBell, I was with George DeBell in Townsville, and George is... He won't mind me saying words. Cricket, he's a man. He's a man who's old enough to have a daughter around the age of 20. So I mean, he's not. You know, he wasn't born yesterday. And he got turned away from a bar at about 9 p.m. for not having an ID. And then we got to Brisbane, and the same thing happened to Paul Newman from the Daily Mail, who's in his 50s, and he's a massive Spurs fan. Again, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this because he's tweeted at the time, but he's a massive Spurs fan, and he went to some bar to watch Spurs late at night play against somebody. He watches every game. He's mad. Anyway, he got to the bar. The bloke said, "Have you got any photo ID?" And it was a little moment where he's got, "Do you really think I need it? I'm a man with not much hair in my early 50s." and so he said, "Look, I've got like, I've got a credit card." Yeah. And the bloke just looks at him and goes, "I'm not a fucking ADM, mate."
Far out.
That is incredible.
Set play from the security guard there, isn't it?
Fuck off, Will. Australia's good. It's 3-0.
Yeah, that's
3-0.
Will, thanks for coming on and enduring that again, mate. And good to hear that you're enjoying the tour. I know you've only got a couple of weeks left, and thanks for your honest insights into how things are going in the UK camp.
Not a problem. Absolute pleasure, lads. Thanks very much.
Cheers, mate.
This summer, we've got the biggest renovation challenge yet. Two teams will have to transform not one, but two broken down grade cricket dressing rooms every single week. There will be tension.
What even is grade cricket, Dazza? Why did we take time off work to do this?
Come on, Charlesy. Work hard, love.
There will be drama.
I just want to make this perfect. Great cricket deserves a great home.
But when the reveal comes, there will be joy.
Oh God. Lads. Boys. Look at this, eh? Results.
Ever since the missus booted me out and took the kids, I've been sleeping in this dressing room. It's a second home to me, literally. So this is really special.
For us to be able to come in and give these grade cricketers a beautiful new dressing room, one they can drink their beers in, sing the club song, judge each other in the showers. Yeah, you know, it makes you feel good.
But this ain't no charity. Not when the stakes are this high.
I'm not here for a bloody holiday. I mean, if I wanted that, I would have gone to Bali or Thailand.
It's Australia's toughest renovation competition. Winner takes all.
If I have to dish out a little bit of chin music, I will.
Presented by Australia's favourite knockabout blue-collared larrikin millionaire.
We're giving great cricket the reno makeover it deserves.
Reno Rampage, coming soon.
Well, here goes. The guy that we've got on this week has not played any test matches, and that's relevant. That's relevant, not because we're going downhill as a show in any way. In fact, I'd say it's the opposite. This guy has, and we're saying this off air, you know, this guy headbutts the line when it comes to the way we think about cricket in Australia and around the world. His name's Trent Woodhill. He's a list manager and assistant coach at Melbourne Stars, batting and fielding coach at Royal Challengers in the IPL, formerly at New South Wales, Surrey, and New Zealand. It's an absolute pleasure to have him on the show. Trent, welcome to the Grade Cricketer.
Thanks very much. Big fan. Glad to be on.
No worries, mate. We always ask people the same question, and I know that you have your own story in this regard, Trent. But I mean, what does grade cricket mean to you? What's your relationship to it?
Well, it's been off and on since 1985-86 at the Southern District Cricket Club, and then to Bankstown, and then to Sydney University. So I've had a real diverse experience with grade cricket in Sydney, and it was just a sort of boy to man experience. And it was brilliant.
I think Boy to Man is the name of our next book that we're talking about. So you're right on the money with that, mate. I mean, my understanding of your grade cricket career, Trent, having sort of read with interest about you, is that you described yourself in a Gideon Hay article last year as a good second grader and an average first grader, which rings a little too close to the bone for me as well. But and the other thing you said was that you basically stopped playing because you got over the anxiety and the sleepless nights before going out to make, you know, zero or three, and then thinking about how you got out. So how'd you go from there to to be involved in the game more and coaching people?
Look, I remember at Bankstown, I rang Dean Moore, who was captain of the first grade team at Bankstown, to say that I wasn't going to play the official trial, the last trial before the season. And he said, "I said, what do you mean you're not going to play?" And then when he said you're not going to play, I went, "Yeah, actually, I'm not going to play at all this season." And it's just one of those moments where I thought, "What the hell am I doing? I'm 26 or 25, and I was working as a sales rep, working pretty hard, and all of a sudden I was nicking off for naught on a Saturday morning and sitting there for 7 hours watching somebody else have fun while I'm thinking about a sales report I have to give on Monday." So there was just zero fun left in it. So I had about 3 years away from the game altogether. And then Dean Moore's younger brother, Danny, started playing at Sydney University, and we stayed in touch, and I went and spent some time with him. And Alan Campbell, who was the former New South Wales High Performance Manager, was coaching there, and I just found I really enjoyed getting around cricket again and being around a different scene and got back into it. But I did not miss it at all. Those times I was down the beach on a Saturday morning, laughing at everybody getting out for naught on a Saturday morning.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of laughter going on the retreat because, you keep summing up the main themes of anything we ever talk about. I think a lot of people listening know exactly what you mean when you describe that. But I suppose the difference between all of us and you is that even though you did have those experiences, you've gone on to become this kind of batting whisperer or, you know, new age coach that has a different way of understanding the way the game could be played. I mean, can you describe a little bit about your coaching philosophy, you know, to those who don't know you and maybe how you've come to arrive at that?
It's trying to work out what a batsman does, what repeats well under pressure. So if you look at someone like a Stephen Smith or a David Warner, it's working out what they do well when they're not under pressure, then how that transforms when they're under pressure, and making sure that there's not a lot of change. So in Stephen's case, we discovered at a young age that anything outside fourth stump or off stump, fourth stump, he would be able to hit through the onside at will, at ease. And that's just seemed natural to him, and it made sense to me. Even though I didn't really understand it, it just made sense though because he could repeat it. And that, so I sort of then realised that the more success someone has is usually what holds up under pressure. So the first thing is just determining who somebody is, what their batting is like, how their mechanics are naturally, and then what I can do to make sure that repeats under pressure as opposed to trying to teach them something new.
So Trent, like obviously, Steve Smith is probably your most well-known client, along with, you know, Dave Warner, Virat Kohli as well, I suppose, and, you know, a number of other wonderful international batsmen. But like, I want to get to the idea of, like, obviously, looking good is one of the most important things in cricket, and Steve Smith, in a lot of ways, is like a right-handed Graham Smith, you know, crabbing across the crease and flicking everything to the leg side and stuff. So I want to know, when you're talking to him, like, was it difficult for him at all to get over the idea that this doesn't look good?
There was pressure. I mean, he was younger, so yeah, 15 or 16. There was pressure to change, and in many ways, he was lucky that he met someone as pig-headed as me that hated someone trying to be forced to change what was different to what they liked. Uh-huh. And cricket's always bugged the hell out of me about the eye test. Everybody has to bat the same way. And that usually stems from Channel 9. Channel 9 are massive on, wow, that's a proper cricket shot, and he's a beautiful player. And they fail to mention that he averages 34 in Test cricket. And but he looks good. That's what they understand, and that's what everybody understands, is they talk about a technique that was formed from a textbook 100 years ago that everybody should apply to their games. And the advent of the IPL, but before that, you know, the Indian players always had a different way about them, and same with the Pakistan players. And the English, you know, with their upright back lifts, and the Australians with their bats down, it was almost like you had to be like the past rather than starting something new that worked for you. And Stephen's broken that mould. And even though the system tried to change that, Stephen luckily stayed away from that.
It's a consistent theme with the stuff we go on about, Trent, you know, is making sure that you always look good and, you know, obey the sort of unwritten rules of cricket to make sure you succeed. I mean, you talk about Stephen breaking the mold, and I'll call him Stephen because I think, you know, that's the best way to show that you know someone is by calling them their full name. But that aside, you say he's broken the mold. I mean, you've broken the mold as well. I can only imagine, you know, as an up and coming coach a few years ago, without a first class game to your name or a test game to your name, how difficult it must have been to impress upon people that there is a different way to play the game, and there is a way you can succeed that wasn't in the MCC rule book, you know, written in 1961. I mean, you must have some stories about, you know, some barriers and obstacles from people along the way.
Oh, thousands, especially in Australia. But I'm lucky. So when I first started coaching Sydney University, my first overseas player was Kevin Peterson. So he's a 22-year-old working with a 32-year-old. And what I learned fast from Kevin was he wasn't interested in what I had done or what I was going to do. All he was interested in how I could help him. And to fast forward then when he was playing at the Delhi Daredevils with Sehwag, both of those two were really big on the fact that they weren't interested in my background. They were only interested in how I could help. Mm. And that was a common thread through New Zealand, many countries overseas. But the backbone of Australian cricket was always about let's tell the sports luncheon story first. Let's tell the old war stories. And what will determine where you sit then as a cricket coach. So you know, even now the whole thing adage around Cricket Australia is about profile appointments, and it's crap in so many ways because more often than not they're appointing people with A, the inability to coach, or B, the no background of success as a coach. So they're putting a lot of pressure and they're asking a lot to deal with people who are very, very good. So if you say the wrong things to David Warner and Steve Smith, you don't want to break those two because you know they're world class players, and you can only make them worse if you say the wrong things rather than make them better.
Mm. That's very insightful, really interesting, Trent. I've got a story that I'm going to ask to see if this is true. It's about you. I was talking to a guy that I was lucky enough to get to know a couple of years ago from St Kilda Cricket Club, also St George, Graham Rummins. I was talking to him about a different piece, and your name came up in conversation. He told a story about, and this is Graham Rummins, who played a lot of cricket for New South Wales and Victoria, very, very talented player, and hugely successful at both clubs. I think he has the run-scoring record at both St George and St Kilda, players who represented them by the names of Don Bradman and Shane Warne. Anyway, and he was talking about him being 19 years old, having just been dropped from first grade to second grade, and he was batting on Hurstville Oval against your Sutherland side, or Bankstown, I can't remember. Bankstown, okay. And he couldn't hit a cut shot to save his life. And at the drinks break, a young Trent Woodhill, who we barely knew, walked up to him and told him that if he just slightly adjusted his grip, that that cut shot would start working for him. And the next cut shot he played went for six. he told me that story, and cricketers don't normally, you know, praise other people. So, I mean, is this true?
It's true. It was a two-day match at Hurstville Oval. I think they got 405 on the Saturday, and we passed them maybe seven down on Sunday. But it might have even been lunchtime on the Saturday. Rummo was just struggling with his catch shot. We had in second grade, we had a couple of really quick bowlers, a guy called Scott Vidler, I think a guy called Greg Trevino, who played a lot of first grade and did really well. And we had a chat at lunchtime, and he came out, and sure enough, first ball after lunch, short ball from Vidler went for six, and the next one went for four, and there was about three guys who looked daggers at me because they knew I had a conversation with him and wanted to know. The silly thing was then, I probably didn't know it, but I enjoyed that more than the crappy 30 I got that game.
Yeah.
So I actually enjoyed the helping side, and yeah, that probably started the journey. I was doing some coaching then with a guy called Barry Davison who was a Sutherland grade club stalwart. So I'd already started coaching, but it was more so, you know, because, you know, any number one of your grade cricketer tweets would suggest that, you know, maybe I wasn't good enough to make it in the first team dressing room, so I coached a bit, I might have got a leg up in that situation.
We all have our way.
Trent, I want to ask you, like, what is it that you would specifically, let's just use Steve Smith again as an example, but when you were talking to Stephen, you know, about batting, I imagine, like, at that level, you know, you're talking about such fine margins between, you know, a guy who's in the best form of his life or he gets a, you know, first ball duck or whatever. So, like, I'd imagine you're not sort of talking to him saying, like, have you tried batting on middle and leg? You know, like, is it, are you talking about his grip? Are you talking about, like, the angles of where a ball's going to, where he can hit it? As you said before, repeating things under pressure. Like, what are some of the things that you would talk about with Stephen, you know, in a session?
So with Stephen and I now, because it's been, yes, since he was 15, we've interacted. It might just be a WhatsApp exchange or a text exchange or a brief phone call. And I think the last time we spoke was before a Shield game at Hurstville Oval. It was around, he was just unsure of his movements because he had a break after the IPL, the MOU, saga dragged on, so he hadn't had much cricket, and that's the first break he'd had for a while. So we just revisited what he did well and spoke about, if his head's forward and in control and his hands are back, his feet are going to fall under his head so they won't move too far and they'll move in a natural way. So we'll sort of revisit that stuff first, and normally that's enough for him to rejig what he needs to. And the best part of what I try and do is making the players responsible for their own game and being their best coaches. If somebody like a David or a Steve relied on me, then they would struggle. They'd struggle because they're inevitably trying to think of something I said out in the middle. And,
sure.
And people like Steve and David, they're very good at knowing their own game. So under pressure, they're reverting to a game management or decision-making process rather than a technical process. Whereas some of the others who are too structured and too mechanical or trying to remember a technique that's been given to them, not something that they've been born with, under pressure, they revert the technique and inevitably it's curtains.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's a little bit more than just good shot made and play straight. Now, Trent, I was hoping... I was hoping you could maybe paint a picture for us, like sort of in the same light as Higo's question. You know, like, I mean, how different would a Royal Challengers, IPL training session in 2017 look, from a Sutherland training session in 1998? If you were having a net with two people from both of those sides, I mean, how far has cricket come along? Do you coach players very differently now? And if so, how? What we would have seen back in that era.
Well, if there's any club coaches listening tonight, there is no harder job than coaching a club side.
Yeah.
It is very, very hard. Turning up to, it's been a wet day and there's 55 players on two synthetic wickets and, you've got old balls slipping everywhere. The old first grade pro trying to do his thing against the fifth grade spinner and having a feel-good net.
Feel good net. That's good.
What I try and do at any level is work out where players' strengths are around hitting the ball, because that's what it's about, is being able to hit the ball, make contact with the ball rather than the ball make contact with you, and whatever area they're strong at, try to expand that, and that applies to all levels. So if a young kid's good at pulling the ball and cutting the ball, if he can pull and cut more balls, he's going to have more scoring opportunities, more chance to celebrate afterwards than if he tries to learn a new shot that when he's batting one and a half times a week, makes it very difficult to do.
I'm just thinking of like some of the shots that some of the international players play, and it looks robotic, in a lot of senses. It's like, this ball is here, I play this shot, and it makes me think, like, I wonder how many hours a week international cricketers are hitting cricket balls. Like, roughly, like, how many hours a week do you think they're hitting balls?
Jeez, it's a good question, isn't it? My shoulder says a lot.
So throwdown still exists.
Just six more, Trent. Okay, then we'll move on to the cover drive. sorry that slipped. I didn't mind to do that. I have a theory on what they need to do as opposed to what they do, but... I think they need to hit every day for maybe 10 to 15 minutes, almost like a golfer going on the driving range, but they don't need to play around a golf every day.
Right.
So I think a lot will have 3 or 4 days off, and then they might have an hour and a half, 2 hour session, rather than the good ones that I've come across just do a little bit every day to maintain their brilliance rather than trying to find or trying to get better. And someone's averaging 50 in Test cricket. They don't have to get better. They just have to be that person every day of the week. And
yeah,
I think the guys just below them maybe strive too hard to try and they think if they hit more balls, that the cricketing gods are going to smile on them. And that's the big thing about cricket, is the superstition involved. So if they had me throwing balls at them the day before they get 100, then rest assured the next time they're going to want me to travel.
Trent, you've been an outspoken promoter of, you know, T20 cricket over Test match cricket, particularly on Twitter. And I know that there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek in that when you do it, but and a bit of devil's advocate there. But, you know, can you give us a little insight into the world of T20 over Test cricket? I mean, you know, how much should we understand T20 to be the future of cricket? Where, you know, where do you think Test cricket will sit or should sit, you know, in the future of Test cricket? In the future of cricket, sorry.
Yeah, well, they keep having pitches like they do at the moment in Test cricket, the game's just going to die. People want a contest, don't you? You just want to feel like that big ball is going to happen all day, not just at one little period with a pink ball under lights. And I think that around the world, people haven't got the time to sit down and watch five-day Test matches. So, you know, things just change. I'm sure in the late 70s when Kerry Packer was talking about changing the face of the game, you know, that he would have created a lot of good arguments why, and there would have been 1,000 more against. I just think that 2020 provides really good entertainment for kids, especially, and families, but also it's a really good entertainment package for an evening. Mm. Test cricket definitely has a place. It's just that the legacy that everybody tries to protect around Test cricket, namely the Channel 9 panel, or, you know, people whose whole lives is literally being about their Test career. You know, so I think former players feel the need to protect the past more than somebody like me who was getting naught at Hurstville Oval on a Sunday morning. So, yeah, I don't know. I like to watch good cricket, but I don't want to watch bad Test matches. You know, that last 4 days or 5 days on crappy wickets against poor opposition, and until teams start winning away from home and they can even the playing field. It, I mean, really, Australia's done nothing since 1992-93 any differently than this year than they have then, other than, you know, they've lost three series, two against South Africa and one against England, and in 1992-93 they lost against the West Indies, and so every summer Australia wins. That's how things go. Mm. So, you know, the thing about the Big Bash is this year could be the year of the Renegades or the Heat. Yeah, there's new faces popping up. There's a freshness to it, and plus I wouldn't want to be involved with 5 days of Test cricket with my phone off now with all that PMO and stuff either.
And just a last one, Trent, as well. There's a lot of people listening to the show, and probably include Higos and I in this as well, who are kind of either ex or, you know, aging club cricketers who do hear a lot of things from coaches or hear a lot of convention being spouted. I mean, what advice would you have, you know, to any cricketer listening to the show out there who wants to improve whatever it is that they do on a Saturday, let's just say in relation to batting? You know, what advice should they not listen to that they probably hear all the time, and what should they start doing?
Things like get yourself in, you know, defence. If you've got a good defensive game, the attack will take care of itself. Watch the ball, play in the V, all those things that I don't think anyone knows what they mean. I think they actually don't know. Don't worry about your grip. Whatever feels good, whatever you do when you take centre or middle of leg or whatever, you know, or ask for two, whatever you do, because under pressure, your technique's going to revert. Your grip's going to tighten in places you didn't think it did during training. So I think it's really important that you try and hit the ball, because then you tend to do that a little bit later, and you tend to watch the ball a little bit harder, and it feels good when you hit the ball. So that, I think that's why you play the game.
I love it. That's so good. Trent, thanks so much for coming on and you know, telling us what we think we've already known but been too scared to admit. We wish you, you know, and the Melbourne Stars and all of your franchises all the best. I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more from you as cricket comes to terms with the fact that there are other ways to play the game, and it's great to talk to the guy who's actually being, you know, bold enough to say that out loud.
Thanks. I really appreciate the time that you guys have given me, and hopefully anything I've said hasn't changed your tact around your tweets. I definitely want to see you guys whinging about bad coaching, bad grade cricket, especially those guys with the big rigs.
It looks like, you know, we're all dealing with our grade cricket past in different ways. You know, you're coaching now, and we're podcasting. So it's all, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's all just one big therapy session anyway.
Correct.
So thanks very much, Trent. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Meet Nugsy. As he orders a Dutch beer in a Japanese brothel, he checks his exclusively Australian My Cricket stats. But more on that contradiction later. Every morning he crawls out of his single bed in a global world, hungover as fuck, barely noticing his ciggies are German, his yellowing 93 Subaru is Japanese, and his favourite protein powder manufactured from the USA. He thinks nothing of chatting with Taiwanese women on OkCupid, while attempting to buy a new stick online with an overdrawn UK debit card, before getting caught up in yet another email phishing scam out of Nigeria. It hardly registers that he buys his $1 machine coffee from an American-Japanese convenience store, catching up on the cricket scores en route to meet his ex-wife at a solicitor's office in Chinatown. Unfortunately, the truly global nature of Nugsy's world only becomes apparent when he realises he's wasted his entire life savings on Australian-grade cricket. From rego fees to training kit, new sticks to post-match circuits. Not to mention a debilitating gambling addiction that has literally cost him everything. Lost everything to cricket? Might as well park some coin in a global managed fund that you don't really understand anyway. Columbus, the global investment experts.
Will McPherson before Trent Woodhill there. Another show. We hope you've been having an absolutely fantastic break, whatever time of the week you listen to this. England may have won a test match. Australia could have won another test match. Who knows what's happening? All of that's just completely irrelevant. Anyway, hashtag AskTGC. It's our favourite time of the week where we answer some of your ridiculous questions. And Elliot Kennedy writes in this week and he says, I met a girl and she claims that she loves cricket. Do such women exist, or am I talking to a guy? Pez, is Elliot talking to a guy? Is he being catfished?
there's every chance that you're being catfished, Elliot. I think I got to put a progressive hat on here. I think a couple of years ago, I probably would have rolled with this joke, but you know, women's cricket's going really well. I mean, I watched BBC like Sports Personality of the Year here the other day. That's a big deal over here. Mm-hmm. And the English women's cricket team were announced as the team of the year. So, and we have a lot. We do have. I was going to say a lot of female listeners. I think that'd be a lie. A lot wouldn't be true, but we do have there are females who listen to the show, so I'm not gonna say that any woman who likes cricket must therefore be a guy. This is certainly not the case,
mate. Have you ever done that thing where like you talk to someone about cricket, and because you're aware that you know more about cricket than the other person, that you don't really want to like go into full, you're almost like embarrassed by the amount that you know about cricket because you're embarrassed that you've wasted a huge part of your life.
Sorry, just an RSTG. You just submitted your own RSTGC question.
Ian Higgins writes in this week and he says, Pez.
Ian Higginbotham, yeah. No, yeah, definitely. That happens quite a lot. And so you try, but then you just sound like a wanker because you try and be sort of diplomatic and oversimplify things with the way you're talking. And then someone will say something that you just really disagree with and you just have to wince and go, do I go or do I not? And you know, then your wife looks at you and says, "Don't, please, not again, like, Sam,
for
Christmas."
For you, what is that like? For me, it's like the Shane Watson thing. You know, like if someone says, "Like, oh fucking," remember when Shane Watson like he DRS'd it, and you're just like, that's my fucking tipping point. Just like if you think Shane Watson was a bad cricketer, you'd like, no, I'm not having it. I'd love to get him on the show.
Watto is the big one, actually. Someone said to me the other day, and actually wasn't too bad a call, really. Someone said to me the other day, oh, I really enjoy it. Like, because Damien Fleming's been doing a lot of commentary on BT over here for the Ashes. So, but you will have heard him on the Big Bash and stuff, and he's got his a couple of his quips around like the avenue of apprehension and the corridor of carnage all of that sort of malarkey, and you know, me being like a wanker highbrow person who's getting sick of that, which says more about me. Let me be really clear about that, and I respect Fleming and all of that, and I'm sitting on the fence with it. But this guy was saying how much he loved it, and it was just as I was about to say, oh God, I can't stand Fleming with his avenue of apprehension stuff. I mean, let's have something more. But That's my problem. That's my problem. That's a genuine, you know, it's a, I think Fleming's a good commentator, so, you know.
Well, it's going to be awkward next week when we've got Damo Fleming on the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Matthew Williams says, "Hi guys, love your work. Hoping you guys can shed some light on current grade cricket naming conventions. The current test team would have to compete as one of the most bogan lineups in recent memory, starting with a Davo, Banger, Uzi, followed by Smithy, Shauno, Mitchie, Timbo, Paddy, Gary and Joshy. The correct quota of bogan names is crucial to team balance and explains how Shane Watson managed to stay in the test team for so long." Well, there we go.
There we go.
Could the inclusion of Jackson Bird from Melbourne divide the team on whether to call him Jacko or Birdie? I'm concerned this may derail the remainder of our Ashes campaign. Also, do you think Cricket Australia have a successful plan based around players' names? I'm worried there's not enough Micks or Robbos coming through the system. Cheers. Keep up the good work, guys. Regards, Matt."
Sometimes you read these questions and you think, how does this stuff come into people's heads? But then you think you started an anonymous account about a fucking club cricketer. So, then you think just take it easy. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those rhetorical questions. I mean, it's a real problem. I mean, at least we don't have the rugby union problem of like double barreled last names too much. Mm.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's still kind of sticking to type.
But then you just call that person two dads, don't you? That's what great cricketers do. If someone's got a double-barreled name, you just call them two dads. Mate, I don't make this stuff up, mate. Those are the rules. You know. Yeah. All right. Last question of the week. I don't think we asked. We answered Dave's question. Oh, maybe we did. I don't know. Matthew Borch writes in and he says, dear Ask TGC, whilst entering the final pages of 2017 standout Christmas gift, Tea and No Sympathy, I found myself smirking at the reference to Brixton's Pop, a Route 1 doffing of the cap to all the Aussie expats here in London. And more specifically to Beckenham's Fee and Brown, a cafe which is local to me and one which I would have, been known to frequent. In addition to being surprised and highly amused by the reference to such a coffee shop in the leafy streets of Zone 4 suburban southeast London, it got me wondering, where the fuck did TJC pull up Fee and Brown from? His recent emigrate to old Blighty Pezza. Pezza been circling in Beckenham, or is this specific reference a blatant attempt at share ramping for the fledgling light snack and caffeine drink serving emporium? If the latter, at what price can I get it? Can I get in at? However, more importantly, perhaps now that Pez has clearly blown his own South London residential cover, can I interpret this as a come get me plea to all South London cricket clubs, and in doing so, tempt him into turning the arm over at my club Dulwich in 2018? Not only is it less than 2 miles from this beloved Brico, not to mention a mere 5 stations from Beckenham, but we boast several off-field benefits which I believe may be of interest to the ex-Bear. These include A, an open lenience towards anyone who wishes to spend 1 in 3 Saturdays away from cricket in the company of actual friends and loved ones. No need to ever miss Glasto or take a week off work to attend the Lord's Test whilst playing. B, tertiary institution-based selections. C, twice annual Brixton circuits. D, the ability to alpha Higos by describing to him what it's like to play for a big club in Surrey Championship. So how about it, Pez? Sincerely yours, Matt, fellow Sydney Uni and North Shore grade club alumni. Well, this question's right up our street that Matthew's asked, isn't it? So, Pez, I'm sure you know this, but I played 3 seasons in Surrey and I played against Matthew's club, Dulwich. I have 2 very good friends who still play for Dulwich. So I can speak with authority when I say it's the worst fucking club in Surrey. No, that's not true. So, I mean, how about it, Pez? Are you going to play for Dulwich? Also, you don't live in South London.
Well, you have to say, Matthew, thank you very much for the question. First things first is I can't really reveal the research methodology as to how I arrived at Fee and Brown, though I Googled it. No. Basically, I don't want to give away the ending, but there's a very significant scene that takes place in Beckenham, and then I just thought, I need to we need to find a cafe near here. I'm going to find the most hipster one, judging by their website. And so I'll probably let you down, Matthew, to know that I don't live in the in that southern region. I'm north of the river in Highbury near Arsenal. But I'd love to have a game. Yeah, a game would be good. You say roll the arm over. If you do want some very low percentage leg spinners that often bounce twice and I end up angry not talking to anybody, I am there. That'd be good. Although, there's a few like complicating factors taking place in the next couple of months around the siring of children, etc., which I won't go into. But it'd be good to have a game, and I appreciate the question. What is this, a fucking press conference? I don't know why I'm talking like that.
Well, Pez, we've done it just between the two of us. Hopefully Dave will be back next week. It's been a wonderful show. Trent, an excellent guest. So fascinating to like see what he like does with these professional athletes. You know, how do they hit so many balls? Why do they hit so many balls? Probably because they're international cricketers, Ian. That's their job. Will McPherson as well on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. If you do want to get in contact with us, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the emails, you know how the internet works. We'll see you next week.